This is an ABC podcast.
Hard copy, online, audio and video, there's so many ways to get the daily news. And in a global community, it's more important than ever to understand what's going on in the rest of the world. I'm Paul Barclay, and in this Big Ideas, we hear from three foreign correspondents about the task of providing international news to domestic audiences. Damien Cave is the Australian Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Louisa Lim now teaches audiovisual journalism at the University of Melbourne, but she was formerly a China and Hong Kong correspondent for the BBC and NPR. And Shamar Khalil, who is the BBC's Australia correspondent. This discussion comes from the Sydney Writers' Festival and is hosted by Jonathan Perlman, the editor of Australian Foreign Affairs. He begins with the essential question of news values. Why, for example, do we hear so much more about the war in Ukraine than we do about the war in Ethiopia? Who decides what's newsworthy? Shamar Khalil.
That's the question that so many editors, so many journalism students ask themselves. What is news and who drives it? Do editorial meetings in big newsrooms decide them? Does human interest and general interest decide them? Do facts on the ground decide them? And I think it's a combination of many things. And, you know, through the years, it's become more difficult to decide what is a headline and what is not. But I would say some things are easier to call, if you will, than others. You know, you mentioned the Arab Spring, which caught everyone by surprise. But when you've got a group of young people taking to the streets demanding change in a region that is known to be very young but governed by very old autocrats, and you suddenly see a domino effect of them being ousted one after another, I don't think there is any doubt that then this is going to be the big story. I mean, you talk about the war in Ukraine, and again, there's been a lot of talk about, well, why aren't we focusing on other wars? I think there are many reasons. One, of course, is the obvious, which is this is a war that is happening right now at the heart of Europe, a place where, to be honest, coming from the Middle East, we have thought was set. You know, it was kind of the stable compass, if you will, of the world that everybody aspires to and wants to be like. And for it to be upset in that way, I think, travels globally. But also there's so many ramifications. It's not just geopolitical. It's the fact that, you know, the war in Ukraine affects the price of bread in Egypt. And so there's so much to get at from this one war, if you will, that it's not just about combat. It's about the ramifications of all of this around the world. You know, I think that really is the start of it.
Damien, do you think there needs to be a local interest or angle for international stories to be newsworthy? I mean, the New York Times is in some ways an international journal of record, so it tries to cover the entire world, right. I think, yeah. Generally. Yeah. But not all media outlets do that. Does there need to be a sort of local, domestic interest for outlets to cover international stories?
Well, I mean, I think part of it depends on how you define local. For the New York Times, the mission is to help our readers understand the world. And so I think we believe that understanding the world is relevant to you no matter where you are. And so the war in Ukraine, for example, yes, it affects bread prices everywhere. It affects supply chains. It does all kinds of things. You should understand that. But it also affects you because it's also about a bigger idea that has ramifications that run through all of our lives. Democracy versus autocracy. The, you know, whether strength might makes right. You know, whether or not self-determination of an individual country is strong enough to withstand a military force and military invasion. These are ideas that go beyond local. And I think there are a lot of ideas in this world these days that transcend our sense of geography. And so I don't necessarily think it has to be local in terms of link to your specific neighborhood, city, country, because there are interconnections that happen, especially in our increasingly interconnected world, that allow these big stories to speak to us and to have relevance to our lives. And then also the final thing I would say too is that even if it feels totally distant from you, there's value in understanding that too. In the same way that reading a great novel that's totally creates a world for you that's imaginary is important for you to understand. Understanding the world in a deep way, even if it's totally distant from your experience, or perhaps even more because it's so distant from your experience, is, I believe, inherently valuable.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to talk about some of the challenges that the media are facing in trying to understand what's happening in the world. And an obvious place to start that discussion is China. It's quite incredible, especially given Australia's relationship to China, that there are basically no permanent Australian correspondents in China today. Louisa, you've covered China and Hong Kong extensively, and I just wonder if you can talk about what are the challenges that are facing journalists trying to cover both China and Hong Kong today, and maybe just talk a little bit about what are we missing out on by not having reporters there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the hardest time, really, since the Cultural Revolution, probably, for journalists covering China. I mean, what we're seeing is a number of different factors that are coming together, but one is this sort of massive decrease in the number of press passes that are given. So that basically means that a lot of journalists have been kicked out, and those journalists that have been not allowed to stay or ejected include the most experienced and knowledgeable journalists covering China, especially like some of the New York Times correspondents and Wall Street Journal ones, who've won Pulitzer Prizes, who've been there for ages, who've got all this institutional knowledge. And so, you know, I think it's also strategic from the part of the Chinese that they don't want people who have language skills and the ability, the tradecraft and the contacts to report these stories. It's really hard reporting in China now. Those few journalists that remain, they find it hard to leave Beijing. Nobody will talk to them, not even on the most kind of boring and pedestrian of stories. The NPR correspondent decided to do a soft story because she thought it would be easy. Emily Fung, she's amazing. Everyone should follow her. So she decided to do a story about snail noodles. Noodles made of snails. And astonishingly, even a subject like that, people she tried to interview were intimidated, told not to speak to her. So there's almost no subject that's non-political anymore. And in Hong Kong, it's even harder. Like in China, the red lines have always been pretty clear, and people know what they're allowed to talk about and what they're not allowed to talk about. But in Hong Kong, there's new legislation that was passed in June 2020, imposed on Hong Kong, this national security legislation, which outlaws secession, subversion, collusion with foreign powers, and terrorism. And that is being used so broadly that even speaking to the foreign press and tweeting is being used against people in Hong Kong to deny them bail or as proof of collusion with foreign powers. People say in Hong Kong there are no red lines, it's just a red sea, because those red lines are multiplying, they're constantly moving, and journalists, Hong Kong journalists, are being targeted. So it's really an extremely difficult and quite a dangerous reporting environment, because you just don't know when you're putting your interviewees at risk or not, and they don't know either.
What does it mean for you? Would you go to Hong Kong to report, and how can you cover what's going on there otherwise?
Well, I wouldn't go back since the national security legislation has passed, and that's partly because of my first book, which was about Tiananmen and the legacy of the 1989 crackdown. And a lot of those alliance which organized the big vigil, the only vigil to remember 1989 on Chinese soil, a lot of those people have ended up arrested and in court on various charges. So I wouldn't go back now. I finished the reporting of my book sort of around the time of COVID, so I couldn't go back after that. And yeah, it makes reporting really hard because there's so much fear. You know, people worry about what they can say to you. People worry about if they can like your post on Facebook. The level of fear is so high. It's actually, I think, higher than when I was in China. I remember the first time after the national security legislation passed and I wanted to interview a playwright who'd written this play, and he said, oh yes, I can do an interview. And then we got online, he was in Germany, I was in Australia, and he said, oh, I'm really sorry, but I can't talk about politics. And what can you do? So we did an interview, but his entire play was political. He couldn't talk about politics. I understood that I couldn't ask him political questions. So we did this dance where we didn't talk about politics, even though it was an entirely political play. But that's what it's like.
And what about for Shaima and Damien, who've covered war zones? I mean, different type of challenge to the challenges that Louisa is talking about. But Shaima, can you just talk a little bit about what it's like to try to cover what's going on the ground when you're in a war zone and when, you know, your life may be under threat, depending on where you go to or what you try to look at?
I think the one thing that I keep in mind all the time, especially when it comes to war zones, is clarity. I think clarity is the most valuable commodity in stories that are anything but clear. The thing about war stories in general is that, in a way, they're easy stories because the headline, when there is a war in Iraq or Ukraine, you know what you're there for, but you're also being fed those lines from different parties. What you see on the ground is not necessarily what is the official story. And so I think the importance of people on the ground, be that in a war or in a difficult place to cover like China, is key, because you can get all those lines, but then you can sit or stand and confidently say that this is not what you're seeing on the ground. Just being very close and being in touch with a story like that gives you, I think, the authority that you need as a journalist to be able to question the official narrative, but also be able to actually bring what is going on. I think that really is the most basic concept of it. But there are so many challenges to that because the story evolves and it keeps changing. And if you look, for example, at a story like Syria, that has changed so much. That has started with clarity about who the two sides were. And then we ended up with the war with ISIS. You see, with Raqqa as the Islamic State capital. And I remember, for example, being in Iraq, being in Mosul, covering the liberation of Mosul, and the lines get so blurred about who's on which side that I think sometimes it's a balance between being on the ground, being in touch with the people on the ground, but also almost taking a step back and trying to connect the dots, which Damien was speaking about before we came up here, to be able to give a clear picture. And one other thing I would say about being on the ground is you have to be honest about where you stand. You have to be honest about the fact that you are not covering the full story. As a journalist, you have to be very transparent. And I've done that many times, for example, when you're in Cairo and you're in Muslim Brotherhood territory, or you're in the government territory, and you have got to say that we're with the Muslim Brotherhood supporters and what you see is half of the story. I think that we need to be much more clear that we don't have all the answers, that we can only speak about what we can speak of at that very moment.
It's interesting, hearing you say that reminds me of, there's a good friend of mine in Baghdad, Sabrina Tevernisi, who's a colleague who's been in Ukraine a lot. And we used to talk about, she would say, you know, covering a war, and I think it's very similar to environments like China, it's like you're looking out a window and it's a blizzard and it's snowing and you see this figure in the distance. And your editor is on the phone saying, well, is it a bear or a moose? And you're staring at it, and you're like, well, I think I see horns, or are those ears or paws?
Yes.
And your editor's like, well, is it a bear or a moose? We need to put it in the paper. And if you're good at this and if you're calm and humble, you might say, you know what? It's a large animal blurred by the signs of the snow outside. And so a lot of foreign correspondence sometimes is figuring out not just what you can say, but what you can't say. And being honest about that and being humble about what your experience is and figuring out how to use the language or the visuals or anything you have to try and put into context this really weird form of uncertainty and certainty that you live in when you're in these environments.
Yeah.
Damien, can you talk a little bit about the way correspondents work, the way the pack works?
Yeah, we were talking about this before, about the different forms of bubbles that form, right? And so, you know, just recently I was in Fiji when Secretary of State Blinken came through, and it was my first return to the bubble of sort of State Department, Washington journalism, traveling in a pack with the Secretary of State. And it was just this sort of bizarre world where everyone knows each other, everyone talks to each other, everyone is kind of making sure that they're not veering too far away from what the others are writing.
Yes.
So it's this kind of like weird hive mentality that if you're not a part of it, looks really bizarre. And, you know, whether it was in Iraq or any big story, there's sort of multiple bubbles. There's sort of the diplomatic bubble, there's the sort of street bubble, maybe there's the general's bubble. And, you know, one of the real challenges is figuring out as an institution which one to emphasize at any given time. time, and how to make sure you're getting as many pieces of that story as possible. And, you know, I'm sure we can all speak to huge conflicts between my bubble and their bubble. I can think of a few. But but yeah, I think it's a real risk. I think, you know, the bubbles can be really problematic at times.
I have a very jaundiced view of the, especially the American press bubble, because at times I would enter it in China, and it would always be such a dispiriting experience. And it was so extraordinary, because we got to go to a Chinese airbase. The PLA was wandering around, the number two in the Chinese army was wandering around, nobody was with him. So I went up to him. Of course, they couldn't speak Chinese either.
Right.
So I went up to him, got a really good on-the-record interview with the, you know, number two in the Chinese army. And, you know, the next day, they were all really annoyed. They were like, well, why didn't you tell us who he was? And I was like, well, why should I? That's not my job.
Right.
But and also, they weren't interested.
Yeah, it was just another non-American person.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's really the danger, and this is something that I think most organizations or all organizations need to be careful of, is that sometimes the emphasis on important journalism is judged by proximity to power. Mm. And I think this is a really, really dangerous pit to fall in, because yes, interviews with big, powerful men and sometimes women are important, but I think putting the emphasis on the importance of that story versus a human story that tells you what is happening on the ground and deeming this as a less important story, that's really dangerous. I think it's very, very important that you get the official comments, that you get as high up the chain in that story as you can. But you have to also, as an organization, as an editor, put emphasis on the importance of human interest, human experience, and also always relate whatever the official statement is to the human experience. Because again, who are we serving, essentially? And you know, you're there on behalf of your readers, you're there on behalf of your viewers, and you're not there to just be close to power. You're there to ask questions that they want to be asking. You're there to relay the stories that you've seen. And I think sometimes the danger of these bubbles, whether it be the Washington bubble or the Canberra bubble that I have yet to decipher and get into, is that so much, A, they become echo chambers, which is so dangerous, and then they become detached from reality almost. And then you start repeating lines that you've heard in that bubble. I guess the emphasis on what's important and what's a headline and what's not a headline then becomes blurred. Whereas I think a good balance between an emphasis on importance, regardless of your proximity to power, I think that's the key.
Shamar Khalil, Louisa Lim, and Damien Cave. You're listening to a discussion on the state of the international media from the Sydney Writers' Festival.
Do you think you need to speak the local language to report in a place?
It helps a lot. It helps a lot. I've been stationed in countries where I don't speak the local language, and I've been stationed in countries where I do speak the local language, and it makes such a difference because it's about eavesdropping as well. It's about getting into the zeitgeist and what people are discussing on the street. And if you're needing translation all the time, A, sometimes things get lost in translation and you're just not going to get the big picture. Having said that, I think that it's important, if you are a foreign correspondent, to be there long enough to learn the language and the culture, you know, like your China correspondent,
yeah.
For example.
I think there are benefits. It's always better to speak the language if you can, but sometimes speaking the language isn't enough. You know, I know plenty of people when I was in Mexico and I speak Spanish who spoke the language, but maybe if they had never left Mexico, might not notice something that I might notice. Or when I was in Iraq and I didn't speak the language and I was working with a really fantastic translator who was just a fantastic journalist, you know, working with that person and sort of bouncing ideas off as both an insider and an outsider was actually super valuable as well. So I think it can be beneficial as long as you're open to what you're.
I think the outsider thing is also really important, which I don't mean to slag off Australian media, of course. It's great and it's fantastic and it's, you know, more power. But I feel sometimes as an outsider, when I move to Australia, I'm like, you know, I speak English. This is going to be a breeze. I'm going to understand everything. It's going to be fine. And then you read some of what's written. There's so much assumed knowledge. There's so much assumed, I don't know, there's just this assumption that you understand what this means, where these places are, the abbreviations, that sometimes I feel if you're going to tell Australia's story, not just to Australians, but to the world, you need to write it in a way that the whole world understands. And I felt, for example, you know, coming from the Middle East, being Egyptian, some of the toughest stories I wrote were about the very region that I was from, because I had so much inside information and I spoke the language that it took a lot of effort to actually detach myself from it and treat it as an outsider.
I mean, I think it's very hard to cover China without speaking Chinese. I think it's very hard to cover it well. And I mean, what we've seen has been a really interesting evolution in the foreign correspondent corps in China. When I got there, it was all white men. Many of them didn't speak Chinese or really basic Chinese. And over time, we're seeing more and more women and a lot of overseas Chinese women who speak native level Chinese, and that's changed the way that people are able to report China. Yeah. It really means, you know, they can go places where white men couldn't. And I mean, I'm half Chinese, and I could use that quite well. I had a peasant outfit, like a farmer outfit that I would put on that I could, you know, where I could travel pretty much as long as my hair was covered and without needing to put other people in danger, which was also a really important thing, right? If you had to take a translator with you somewhere, there's a really high risk for them. And, you know, some news organizations would just send translators without journalists, which is so dangerous. So I think a language is important. And I mean, you know, for the coverage of China, globally now, Chinese language is important. And I think that's why the Australian media has done a pretty poor job at covering Chinese influence in Australia, is because it's overwhelmingly white and there were just not that many Chinese speakers in Australian news institutions. And I know because I get these phone calls from editors going, oh, do you have any students who are Chinese who can work for us? You know, and there's a real hunger for them now. But, you know, these newsrooms should be diverse. They should represent the country that we live in. They should be able to cover these stories with more nuance. And it's just a problem that at a very senior level, there's just not enough diversity. And also, I think, not enough women in Australian newsrooms at high levels.
I think generally, I mean, there are more and more coming up. I mean, I'd like to see more in senior decision-making levels, for sure, because that will make a big difference. And I can tell you that, again, being on the ground as women journalists, a lot of the time you talk about the dangers of being a woman in a war zone or in a conflict zone. There are so many perks to being a woman in a conflict zone because, again, you can get into those deep, very private spots that men can't, because you've got this access to the household in sometimes very dangerous and inaccessible areas.
And you can tell much more personal stories.
Can you give some examples of your experience of that, where you've had that sort of access?
An example, there are many, but I think one, because we've been talking about Iraq and about ISIS, and I remember at the time, you have very interesting conversations because, of course, there is the diplomatic bubble and there's the political bubble. There is a frontline bubble as well. And it's adrenaline driven and it's all about getting that shot of being shot at. And I must say, and I must applaud all my colleagues that work on the front line, because it's a very, very dangerous and difficult job. And they are very aware of safety and they are very aware of the safety of their teams and they put themselves in danger. I will say, however, that again, this emphasis on that this is the most important story and the only important story sometimes can get frustrating because there's so many other things to cover in a conflict zone than just a front line. And so an example of that, I think it must have been 2015. It was a time when the Kurdish forces and some of the coalition forces were going in to free Mosul from ISIS, from the Islamic State, so-called Islamic State. And I remember in their desperate bid to resist, they started going into female hostels. And that particular one happened to be a Christian female hostel that they took refuge in. And so obviously it was a really dangerous situation for these girls who essentially had to hide under their beds for a couple of days until these fighters left. And so speaking the language and being able to go to these places and being able to speak to being a woman and being able to speak to women, it was a very difficult story to tell. It wasn't from the front line. We weren't being shot at. But it was a real danger of what it's like to be a woman, a Christian woman, in a war zone where the Islamic State were in their kind of last breath, really, and what a desperate Islamic State fighter would do and where they would hide it, and what that felt like, hiding under a bed where an Islamic State fighter was being treated. And I would say that being a woman, being an Arab woman in that situation, not necessarily on the front line, helped me tell that story.
Louise, what about your experience in reporting from China? How does gender affect your reporting there?
In some ways, it was really helpful because I could go places and do stories that my male correspondents couldn't do. But I think there was the other thing, there was a lot of sexism. So whoever you interviewed, they pretty much, especially if they were officials, always looked down on you. And that was actually quite useful as a journalist. Well, I do remember one of my first jobs when I was first joined the BBC, and I went out to Xinjiang and I was interviewing an official, a health official about AIDS. And I just remember he went into the other room and he said really loudly, "I can't believe they sent the intern." I was so annoyed. And I didn't say, "I'm not the intern." I just put on my sort of sweetest, most stupid smile, asked questions where he's incriminated himself quite badly, and then put in what he said. But that dynamic, no matter how old I am, continues to this day. You know, I think people still aren't used to necessarily, they always expect if you're going to see a BBC correspondent, it's going to be a tall white man, right?
Yes. Yes.
And they're a little bit disappointed when you're not.
Yeah. And I think also the image of an organization is quite interesting because all these big names, the BBC, the New York Times, the Washington Post, have a historical image, if you will. And the image of these organizations is changing, not fast enough.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you say the Australia correspondent and there is a certain expectation and then someone like me shows up. And, you know, and it's an interesting reaction, I would say. And it's been different in different places. But I think it's up to you to remember the job, right? I think it's up to you to remember what you're there for.
Yeah, I'd really like to talk, given that we have three international reporters and reporters from abroad who've ended up in Australia. I'd like to just get a sense of what the international media is interested in when it comes to Australia. Damien, you set up the New York Times bureau here. What is the New York Times interested in when it comes to Australia?
Everything, of course. No, every country sort of has a set of ideas or stories that kind of get retold again and again. In Mexico, for me, it was immigration and drugs. And in Australia, historically, it's been crazy animals and crazy nature, right? And so when I got here, I tried to make a determination pretty quickly to say, okay, the first year, no animal stories. We're not going to do that. I think we got through the whole year. I'm not sure. I can't promise that. But I think that Australia really plays an interesting place in the world and a whole bunch of these issues that I was talking about earlier that are kind of borderless. So whether it's climate change or migration or the way democracies work or the contest of power between China and the United States, you know, Australia is really in the center of a lot of those big global stories.
Yes.
And so for us, those are the kinds of things we think about, not just here, but around the world. What are the stories that connect our world in a way and that can be told from anywhere? And then we try to sort of figure out, well, how can we tell this story in a way, and this is, if we have a mantra, this is sort of it, and I'm stealing it from Sam Sifton, who's our food editor, who came to visit and gave this to me when I was like, "Sam, what the hell should I do? I just opened this bureau." And he said, "Well, Damien, it's obvious. You should just try to reveal Australia to itself and to the world." And to some degree, I think that's what we try to do.
We've been talking about challenges that international media and international reporters face, and I just wonder if you can talk about some of the challenges that you think exist in Australia. I mean, I'm interested in what sort of access you
very little
get. Yeah. can you talk about that?
We were talking about this earlier too. I mean, I've written about this before, but I think Australia is one of the most secretive democracies in the world. And I think the culture of secrecy here is really problematic. It starts at the very top. It's very insular and parochial in the way that government works and the way that journalism works. Canberra is a bubble, and it is a bubble that's very hard for the New York Times or any place else to break into. You know, officials don't really know what to make of us. They can't put us on one side of the political spectrum. They don't know what the benefits are of talking to us, and they don't feel an obligation to share information with the world. And so I think it's a really difficult country actually to be a correspondent in, and I've worked in probably 25 different countries at this point.
I agree. I think the insulation is palpable, really, because it's a place where you can feel like an outsider quite easily, especially if you're a foreign correspondent trying to cover it to the world, and especially if you're trying to cover politics, which more and more Australia is becoming a really, really interesting place of focus, not just for climate change and environmental challenges that it's facing, not just because of the fossil fuel and climate debate, not just because of its problematic relationship with China at the moment, which is a huge, huge geopolitical story, but the inner workings of politics itself is quite confusing to the rest of the world. And for you to try and get in and again, untangle that and deconstruct it, you know, it's quite challenging because it's almost like the Canberra bubble, whether it's the politician or the political correspondents, they almost have a common language, and you as an outsider need to either speak it or it becomes very difficult to access. And again, that thing that Damien said about, well, there's no benefit really in speaking to you, so why should we?
And I think another thing that makes covering Australia really hard is the defamation laws, which mean that lawyers play a far larger part in any story than in any place I've ever been before. And, you know, you can write stories that just get eviscerated by lawyers. There's nothing you can do about it. And I actually ended up writing an op-ed for the New York Times about how Australia is the defamation capital of the world. Another challenge, apart from the legal side of things, is the insularity of the Australian media itself, where that press pack mentality is also quite strong. And so, you know, when I arrived in 2016 and I wanted to do a lot of stories about Australian influence, I kept trying to pitch them to Australian publications. They go, no, we're not interested. Not really a story. It wasn't that it wasn't a story. It was just there was no one who understood enough about China. And I think probably it's not just China, but other places as well, to understand not only was this a big story, but this is going to be a sustained and continuing story that needs more examination. And again, that comes back to the whiteness and the insularity of not just media, but all institutions in Australia.
I will say one last thing, and again, this is not a slag off. I'm going to preface this by saying this is a very, very good program, and the people on this program are top-notch. But it tells you a lot that the top political program on the national broadcaster on a Sunday is called Insiders. It's very informative, but it just tells you everything you need to know. Anyway, that's just us.
Foreign correspondents Shamar Khalil, Louisa Lim and Damien Cave, speaking at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Host Jonathan Perlman now invites questions from the audience.
I think as a news consumer, it's a really interesting time. So, for example, in the war in Ukraine, you've got so much social media footage going on, which we've never had in conflicts and before to the extent that we have now. But then on the other hand, I think you get the sense that there's fewer and fewer outlets that have actually reporters particularly permanently stationed on the ground in countries overseas. So I was just curious if you feel that in general we're getting closer or further away as news consumers from the reality of what's happening in the world over time.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious what you guys think. I actually think it's gotten better. I think that the people who cover the world, I think the community of journalists that cover the world is more diverse and more knowledgeable and has expanded quite a bit in terms of who does it and how we do it. I think there's access to more information, you know, that is on the ground like that. I mean, we have a whole video investigations team that's doing a lot of kind of open source discovery of things to really find out what's going on in places, even from their desks in New York or from other parts of the world. So I think the tools have gotten better and stronger too. So that's sort of on the positive side of the ledger. On the negative side, I think there is so much more problems with misinformation. Yes. And so it's much harder, even if you're doing better journalism, it's harder for that journalism to break through in a world of algorithms, in a world of misinformation, in a world of distrust. And so one of the things I think a lot about, and one of the things I think our institutions are still trying to figure out, is how you make sure that that solid, credible information, as great as it might be, really breaks through and can change the debate and actually serve the people in a way when you have all this other stuff on the other side that muddies the waters.
I think especially that as a news consumer, you can pretty much curate your news content for yourself based on your beliefs and your values and who you go to dinner with and what TV shows you watch. And the diversity of news sources and the diversity of what you can get, whether it's on the internet or social media, is astounding. But I think what it's created that's really dangerous is news content and opinion silos, where you can pretty much go to sources that you're used to and listen to yourself being repeated over and over again. And you almost have to make an effort to seek an opposite point of view, which sometimes is hard to get if already your Facebook and your Twitter and your Instagram and your search engine has already decided what kind of consumer you are, what kind of voter you are. And so I think the onus is on us, of course, as news organizations to try and reach and tell those stories as extensively as possible, as clearly as possible. Again, clarity. But there's also a lot that has to do with, well, you've got all of this information. What do you use? What do you read? I always tell, especially journalism students, If you're gravitating towards something, make it your business to read the opposite of what you normally gravitate towards.
I just had a quick question on the role of the West in the mediatization of conflict. I think we've spoken about Ukraine this afternoon, and I specifically refer to the way the West frames Ukrainian refugees as having a more legitimized status and comparing it to other conflicts such as Syrian refugees, specifically in Australia, considering we have such a xenophobic response to immigration. What are your thoughts on the role of the West in pitting conflicts against each other?
It's something that I think we've all thought about as journalists, and it's a great frustration, I think, to all of us who have covered refugees in lots of different parts of the world to see the way that the whole conversation gets skewed when it's Ukraine versus Syria or Iraq or any other places that we've covered. So there's something heartbreaking about that, and I don't totally know, and this is just me, I don't know who to blame or how to fix that sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like, is it the media? Maybe a little. Is it governments in Europe? Probably more. Is it places like Australia that support that same narrative? Certainly. But how you sort of break out of that is an enormous challenge. And I think it's a very valid question to sort of ask. The only other thing I would say is, you know, we're in this moment where the laws of asylum that were sort of created many, many decades ago don't necessarily fit the world that we live in anymore. And you really don't have a whole lot of global leadership on really trying to fix that because it's in no one's interest and it's such a hot button issue. So I think that there's a kind of global structural institutional problem that this represents that goes beyond the West.
And I think also what happened in the war in Ukraine is that it challenged the concept of who a refugee is and what a refugee looks like. And what the war in Ukraine has done is that it has challenged that concept that a refugee is anybody under that impossible circumstance, under that impossible condition of being forced out of their country. Doesn't matter where you are.
We've spoken a lot about China, but not about Russia. And I wanted to get your take on the media shutdown with the new law in March this year, and how it has impacted on your newsrooms.
It is. I mean, I know for us that, you know, our Russia correspondents are not in Russia right now. We have a lot of Russian speakers and a really strong crew of reporters who cover that part of the world. And they're not unlike our chief China correspondent, who's now in Sydney, trying to figure out how to cover a place that they're not in. And so it is a severe problem. And unfortunately, I've seen it, you're seeing this in more and more countries where this has become acceptable and they no longer feel like they need to have international correspondents to tell their story to the world or feel obliged to do that. So sadly, I think we're gonna see this again and again. We have reporters that we can't get into Venezuela. I used to have a really hard time getting into Cuba, you know, Russia. There's just country, Syria, there's country after country that are basically keeping us out because they don't want our nuanced, complicated journalism, and it's a real problem.
I mean, the thing to remember is that foreign correspondents, foreign bureaus in general, are a very, very expensive part of news coverage. At a time when you've got people posting videos from the ground and an argument, well, why can't we just get this from someone on the desk? And again, the being on the ground for a long time, and I must stress that you have to be on the ground for a long time to absorb the nuances of the story, to absorb the social differences. I've been here 3 years, and the things that Australians have been through in just 3 years are astounding. And I'm not even talking about the pandemic. I arrived here and I covered the catastrophic bushfires, some of the worst bushfires this country has seen. Last week I was in Brisbane speaking to people whose homes have been destroyed by floods. That happened in 3 years. And then this is a country that is still talking about being wedded to fossil fuels. It's still talking about what it means to be a country without coal. What I'm trying to say is that you don't get that understanding of the Australian psyche, of the Chinese psyche, of wherever, if you're in and out, if you're on a desk somewhere in London. And this is why I feel the pain, for example, of our Russia correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, who was kicked out of Moscow, because she's being asked, or, you know, she has to contemplate covering Russia from outside Russia. And it's very, very difficult. So the argument of being on the ground, of telling us that story on location, is invaluable, not in the everyday, oh, here's an interesting video. It's when big shifts happen that have been in the making for months and months, if not years.
Two questions, but I'll only ask one. In our News Corp dominated media environment, what stories are Australians not hearing that they need to be hearing?
Oh, there's so many.
One of the things that I'm super fascinated about Australia is the degree to which this sort of period of enormous wealth of the past 30 years has affected the country's sense of egalitarian identity. Mm. You know, class is a verboten topic that nobody really talks about very much in Australia. Mm. And as a working class kid from a factory town in Massachusetts, maybe that's my lens that I see the world through. But I do feel like that story is not very well explored. And one of the most interesting pieces of the puzzle, one of the only things I've read that actually touched on it a bit was Richard Flanagan's last novel, which is purportedly about climate change, but it's also really about a family that grew up, you know, as a bunch of battlers in Tasmania and then produced a bunch of sort of eastern suburb Sydney folks who had a different sense of identity and a different sense of what they wanted from their country. And so I feel like there could be a lot more room for conversations again about what Australians have become and what they want to be, even if it's uncomfortable.
I was going to say that. Do you know what it is that struck me about Australia, other than it's beautiful and breathtaking when there aren't fires and smoke, is how comfortable this country is. I come from a region and a place of perpetual discomfort. And as a child and as a teenager and as an adult, especially if you're a female adult coming from the Middle East or a conflict area, is that you are trained, you know, innately to deal with discomfort. And I think that the most interesting thing I found about the Australian sentiment in general is that lack of, it's almost like an avoidance of discomfort. This has been a comfortable, lucky country for a very, very long time, and it's headed towards a very uncomfortable phase of its existence in a very, very uncomfortable world. And it's almost like all of this is kind of honing in on it, and the general internal psyche, if you will, is so resistant to that. It's almost like we're fine. Yeah. We're okay.
She'll be right, man.
And we're fine, and everything is going to be all right. And maybe it is, but also maybe it isn't. And to face up to the fact that this is not going to be as comfortable or as prosperous as it used to be is really, really important. And I think, again, we're talking about the trickle down. That goes, I think, from the education system to the way that we look at stories. Everything that is not comfortable is almost seen as an inconvenience. And I think, you know, generally it's okay to be uncomfortable and to embrace the discomfort. I think that's the other thing. It's just generally an audience that is okay with being uncomfortable is important.
I also think there's still a reckoning to be had over climate change reporting and environment reporting. I think it's just been such a stigma about any kind of reporting on talking about climate change has affected everybody. And I feel that only now are we beginning to see, you know, these big picture, big series about the impact of Australia's climate change policies on the rest of the world. We're getting these much more big picture looks, but I feel like there needs to be more of a reckoning
on
that.
The BBC also does that, by the way.
I'm sure the New York Times does as well.
Yeah. The New York Times.
I think we've got time for one very, very quick question.
I know that we've spoken a lot about bubbles, and I think the biggest bubble that is not spoken about is that Australia, in a global sense, is kind of in a bubble. It seems to me that there's national journalism and then there's international journalism, even within Australia, and they don't really seem to connect. What is the role that journalists can play in starting to bridge that gap? As it probably will strengthen a lot of these questions around identity and where we see ourselves in the international sphere.
I think international journalists can report on these things that are that Australian journalists aren't. That's how that gap gets straddled and filled and covered. And I think it could also push Australian journalists out of their bubble. And I mean, I think we are seeing some of that, but we need to see more. I mean, in many cases, Australian journalists are probably only reading their competitors in the Australian press, and that's why it's become so insular. But I think there's definitely a role to play.
Yeah, I think it's gotten better, too, in the time that I've been here. I think Australian media has improved. I actually think the fires were a bit of a turning point where the Canberra bubble has always been so over-resourced, and suddenly reporters had to get out into the big country.
Yeah.
And I think since then, there's more of a balance between what you see from political institutional voices and what you see from community voices. And there's more international coverage. I mean, I think, you know, the Washington Post just opened a bureau here. You know, we're here. There's a lot of sort of interest in Australia from the world. So I actually think it's a moment of great potential. And I think events like this actually make a difference, too. I mean, I think some of these lines can and should be blurred. We should all just do great journalism that speaks not just to an insular small community, but to the wider world that Australia is a part of.
And I think, yeah, that realization that there is a great deal of international interest in Australia and in Australian news, and not just about the animal stories anymore. You know, this has become a real important spot for many geopolitical power play in the region, but also around the world. And the more that Australian media can tell the Australian story to the world, I think the more understanding that we're going to get about the role Australia has to play in the future of the region.
The BBC's Australia correspondent, Shamar Khalil, with Damien Cave, the Australian Bureau Chief of the New York Times, and Louisa Lim, formerly China and Hong Kong correspondent for the BBC and NPR, and now a senior lecturer in audiovisual journalism at the University of Melbourne. The host was Jonathan Perlman, the editor of Australian Foreign Affairs. The foreign correspondent in the field is up against a new reporter, social media. Anyone with a mobile phone can now post images, video, and text to the internet, and the information is shared and reposted thousands of times in the ever-expanding social media ecosystem. It's news, but is it real or fake news? In a previous Big Ideas, I spoke to four international journalists about the epidemic of fake news and its impact on traditional news organisations.
Now, because of the ease of iMovie or Photoshop that your eight-year-old child can master, it's easier than ever to create false content, and you can spread it more quickly than we've ever had ways of spreading before, and it's spreading through networks that are peer-to-peer. So actually, people are much more likely to trust their friends. So it's easier to create, it's easier to disseminate, and people are less critical of it because it's coming from their friends and family.
And when we use this term, fake news, a term I know you don't like that term, it's a catch-all for information that is either completely or partially incorrect. What do we mean by it? When this term is used, it encompasses everything from deliberate disinformation, propaganda, all of the way down to stuff that we think is true that we're innocently sharing with our friends, right?
Yeah, so I think we need to think about different types. And I talk about parody and satire being a particular type. People don't create it to deceive, but it can have that impact. All the way through to imposter content, when people take ABC's logo or your name and they create false content, but it looks like it's real, to actually a correct photo, but it's old, it's from 4 years ago, and people share it. So I talk about pollution, and there's a scale of that. But when you think about those types, you also think about a graph, and you think about the other axis, which is motivations. So are people doing this simply for profit? Are they doing it to deliberately to deceive, but for fun, to punk? Or is this propaganda, which is disinformation, and it's a sophisticated, systematic campaign? So we need to think about the different types, and we need to think the different motivations. Because if we're going to come up with solutions, we actually have to recognize this is much more complex. And that's why I get frustrated with the term fake news, because we're not going to come up with solutions when we're not clear about our definitions.
Is there a hierarchy? Is some forms of disinformation and misinformation more serious than others?
Yes, yeah, so I think to explain the difference between misinformation and disinformation is when we make mistakes. And like you say, all of us have probably shared something that we shouldn't have done. We didn't, you know, go out to deceive, but we, you know, it's confusing. We live in a confusing space. But disinformation are systematic campaigns deliberately designed to deceive, and that could be from an authoritarian regime. It could be from a PR company that's deliberately attempting to sell something.
Yes.
So we have to think about the difference between misinformation and disinformation.
Because there are actually factories, troll factories and bots out there that are very deliberately and in a very sophisticated manner pumping out into the social media ecosystem fake news. This sounds particularly worrying. Just tell us a little bit about that.
I'm going to be the first person to say Trump. If this was a drinking game, we could probably be drunk. But, you know, I'm glad in one way that Trump has shone a spotlight on this, but it's not new. And anybody, particularly from this region, I mean, the Philippines has been fighting this very seriously for 8 or 9 months. And even before that, you look at Azerbaijan or Bahrain. You know, this isn't new, but Trump has caused people to look at it. But this idea of bots, automated Twitter bots, which are very easy to create, and you basically push out systematic campaigns. And you can see, if you map this, it actually looks like a virus. If you map out what the Twitter ecosystem looks like, it looks one way. If you start looking at these bot networks, it's quite clear they all follow each other. They used to all be eggs, but now they're very sophisticated. So they're actually following each other. They've got profiles. Sometimes they inhabit accounts. So for example, if you're a gymnasium, you decide that a better Twitter account becomes available. You don't close down your original Twitter account. Bots will come in and inhabit your Twitter account and start using it as a shell, and they'll copy your picture, they'll copy your information. So it's very sophisticated, and troll factories where people are sitting in spaces being told what to type, astroturfing, going into communities, being told what... This is, I think most people don't understand the scale of this, and certainly in Europe, we're very worried about the impact on the French and German elections.
Yeah, wow. Andy, has the whole digital news ecosystem become so polluted and so tainted now with misinformation and disinformation that it's diminishing the importance and the credibility of the news, the real news that's on those platforms?
Absolutely. If you look at the kinds of crap that circulates today, whether it's stuff that's rather trivial to stuff that's potentially geopolitically important, it's completely flooding social media in particular, but the internet as well. And because social tools have made sharing as simple as clicking a button that says share on it, it has lowered the barrier to entry for anyone to become a propagandist. It's not new. I mean, people have been posting false information on the internet since the internet was created. I remember back like 1994 and 1995, this Swedish PR firm to test the design of a website created a fake news site that said Pol Pot had just fled Cambodia and was now requesting asylum in Sweden, and it showed him getting off a plane in sunglasses and waving. And the website was TASS.net. And some news organizations picked it up because they thought TASS was ITAR, TASS, the Russian news agency. Now, mind you, this is when you had to create web pages by hand. There was no social media, there was no Twitter, and yet it still got out there. And so in many ways, it was just a matter of time before the tools made it worse to amplify both misinformation and disinformation. And tech companies are struggling to come up with a technological solution, so the question I keep asking myself, is it ultimately a human solution where our role as journalists needs to take seriously the idea that we teach people the media literacy skills so they become good bullshit detectors in their own right?
Yeah, we will come to that. It's an important point, but I'm just interested. It has been around for a long time, the type of misinformation that you're talking about, since the internet arrived. That's true. What's changed, though, is the enthusiasm of mainstream media organisations to get into that space. What are the dangers for mainstream media organisations that in the past were able to protect the integrity of their information? What are the dangers of unleashing our content into this space?
Oh, that ship has already sailed a long, long time ago. For news organizations to not be on that space has to essentially secure their relevancy. The question is what responsibility news outlets feel like have. And historically, if you've got a news brand with a web page and Twitter account and Facebook, those are the only things they care about. They want to make sure that those things are running properly and the information is correct. But if Twitter, the rest of the Twitter sphere is talking about some crazy rumor, or Reddit has gone wild with some information, they often just kind of shrug and say, well, it's not our problem, because we just need to make sure our audiences know that they have the right information. The problem is that you don't have your audience anymore. It's now so mixed up together that you, I think, have a public interest responsibility to be able to jump in whenever possible and stop some of these rumors and nipping them in the bud, whether it's coming out of your network of platforms or it's happening somewhere totally else.
Andy Carvin, Senior Editor-at-Large at Now This News, and Claire Wardle, Head of Strategy and Research at First Draft News. You can hear the full discussion on trust and truth in the digital age by clicking the link on the Big Ideas homepage. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.